Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue finishing up talking about pipelining and handling pipeline hazards. And then we're going to move on to talking about our next topic, which is caching, making our memories actually work the way they're supposed to. So first, a logistical issue. So I released a new version of HTLS for tar. There are two changes, neither of which like absolutely requires you to download it, but you might want to. One of which is that the test for seek homework and pipe homework 2 include poptest.yo. This test depends on what you do for pop RSP. Most of you accidentally make it do the right thing, but we don't actually care if you which value you write into RSP of the value from memory or the RSP plus whatever, minus whatever. So we don't actually want those test lists on the list of tests you have to pass. And this is noted in the homework write-ups now. Previously, HTLRS would let you assign to the output of a register and it wouldn't complain about this, even though that's wrong, and you get like sort of a non-deterministic value for what the, in this case, big Y foo is. So this new version will give an error which explains what's going on if you try to do that, which will matter more if you do pipelining. If you do that before, it's just wrong, but there won't be an error. We'll just choose a value for Y foo of the two choices. So also, on speaking of pipeline hazards, people did a lot less well on the post quiz last week than I expect, so I'm going to start by going over a lot of those questions. So let's start with a question about data hazards. So the question was asking, in which of these assembly snippets do we have a data hazard on our 5-stage pipeline processor? So in this case, we have one instruction that reads from RCX, writes to RDX, and reads from RCX and reads from RDX, and it writes to memory. So it doesn't write to RDX because it's RMOVQ. RMOVQ doesn't write to a register. And then we have an add instruction which reads from RCX and RDX and writes to RDX. Because the add instruction doesn't read from registers, the other instructions wrote, there's no data hazard here. There's no data dependency. No data dependency means no data hazard. So this was not a hazard, even though the registers happen to be related. Zother was asking about a case where we had an add followed by two nops and another add where they shared a register. The output register of the first add was an input to the second. So there is a data dependency here, and the question is there a hazard? And many of you thought that there wouldn't be. And this is probably either thinking about the pipeline we had dealt with earlier, which was pipeline we dealt with earlier with the only adds where we didn't have a memory stage, or you were had it off by one in your counting. So with our 5-stage pipeline, when the first add instruction is in write back, the last add instruction is in decode. And if you remember how the register file works, we need to wait till the end of the write back stage for it to actually change the value in the register. But our decode step reads the register in the middle of the stage. So this is just slightly too late for this to work without forwarding, or stalling, of course. And so that means there's a hazard because our pipeline, before we did any stalling or forwarding, didn't handle this. So, and any questions about anything on question one on the quiz? Besides what I've talked about? Okay. So question two was asking about how you squash an instruction. And the goal, it said, was to squash the instruction currently in execute. So if we have our instructions here, A, B, C, D, E, are the current instructions in the pipeline, you want it to be the case that none of the question marks are C. That's what it means to squash it. We're canceling it, we're getting rid of it from the pipeline. So we can look through the options and figure out what do they do as far as instruction C is concerned. So the correct answer was that we bubble on the execute to memory registers. So naturally, the normal thing for the execute to memory pipeline registers to do would be to pass instruction C so it appears in memory in the next clock cycle. We bubble, replace it with an op, and if we do everything else normally, this means that we don't have instruction C in the next cycle at all. I also accept it if you said to stall the execute to memory registers, though this is not as good an answer, because this indeed gets rid of instruction C. It's no longer in the pipeline. It also means we're stalling the instruction in the memory stage, which maybe we didn't want to do, but it certainly gets rid of instruction C, so that was accepted too. We look at the options involving the decode to execute registers. So if we stall the decode to execute register, that definitely doesn't do the right thing because it keeps C in the pipeline. Because it stall means repeat the old value you had, the old value was instruction C, so that will make sure C stays in the pipeline. And if we don't do anything else, in fact, we have two copies of C in the pipeline now. And if we bubble the code to execute, if we don't do anything else, we're still passing C to the memory stage, so that wouldn't solve the problem. So questions about how the bubble install works? Squashing? Okay. Everyone good? So another question asks about what cycle two things were, instructions were in when we had a jump in between them. And if you remember, our policy for predicting conditional jumps, the one in our textbook, the one we used in lecture, is we say they're always taken. And the question told you it was not taken, so this is a mispredicted jump. And the way our processor works, we compute the result of the jump in the execute stage. And we compute it apparently too late to use it that cycle, so it's the next cycle when we're able to actually use that result and fetch the correct instruction. And so given that, you get this sort of timeline. You got the jump, get to the execute stage, and at that point, you can fetch the correct instruction, and before that point, you're predicting instructions, and in this case, we're predicting wrong. And when you draw this sort of timeline, you can figure out the answer to the question, which was asking what stage is M remove Q in when add is being fetched. You just look down, add is fetched, M remove Q has a W, it's in write back. And yes, as I mentioned before, I strongly recommend drawing a picture like this because I will get this question wrong most of the time if I don't do that. So the last question was, the last two questions were asking about this hypothetical pipeline where we split up our register file into two stages. So we had a slow register file, so it took two stages, so it took two cycles to read a value and two cycles to write a value. And this meant, as written in the question, that we needed to wait until after write back two to read a value that was written. And so we started to code one after write back two if we were reading the value just written. So given that, you can figure out how much you need to stall to make the two transfers of values happen. So we need RAX to go from the I remove Q to the M remove Q, and RBX to go from the M remove Q to the sub Q. And if you add up how much waiting you're doing here, you get that this is at least 10 cycles. You have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 cycles that we're waiting. And note that what I did here is I just lined up the working decode one with the write back two, based on what the question said was our restriction. So the second part of this question asks, well, what if we have forwarding? Definitely gets better because we're doing stalling and forwarding. It can't be any worse. You can always just choose to only stall. So in that case, we need to figure out when can we get the value and where do we need it. So in the case of mremoveq, we need the value in execute because we're using it to compute the address. And if we look at mremove queues execute, well, the value's computed the cycle before, so that's a fine forwarding to do without any stall. Now, if we look at the subqueue, we need the value in execute, and if we didn't stall, then the execute is a bit too late because the value comes from memory. It's not available yet. So in this case, we need to stall one cycle, and that was the answer. So questions about figuring this type of problem out? So that's all I have on the post quiz. So if you remember, we finished up our five. Yes.
Can we go back to that?
Sure.
Why are you allowed to send it to D2 and not D1? Why is it not a requirement that you have to send it to D1?
We can. So the question is, why is the forwarding from memory? Why are we forwarding to the end of the code 2? Why don't we have to forward it earlier? So the only restriction in forwarding is that we need to get the value there by the time it's used. So as long as we can get the value any cycle before execute, we're fine. And any of those options would work. When you're implementing your processor, you're probably just going to forward to the end of the code because that handles all the cases that we care about. But any place, forwarding to any place is fine as long as it's before you use the value. And of course, it also needs to be the case that the value is actually computed by that time. So in this case, we kind of had to forward that late because otherwise we'd be waiting extra cycles for the memory stage. So when we've done all this branch prediction and forwarding, mentioned that this is the processor we ended up with. We basically complete one instruction a cycle. We handle most hazards, most of the data hazards with forwarding. We handle our load use hazard with stalling and forwarding. So we have one cycle stalls on this load use situation. We have branch prediction to handle our conditional jump hazard. So there we have this two cycle penalty if we guess wrong, where we need to cancel some instructions, otherwise it's free. That was sort of our alternative to stalling. And for return, we don't know how to deal with that. So we don't know how to make a good prediction, so instead we just always stall. We always wait until we get the value from memory, which tells us where to jump to. So there's some missing pieces in our pipeline processor that we're going to talk about over the next couple weeks. So one of these is going to be about multi-cycle memories, and this is going to be what our caches are all about. They're the real memories we have in our processor. So right now, we're talking about memories which you supply a value, you've got something in the same cycle, you write a value, it writes in one cycle, and this is sort of the ideal case. And the way we make this happen is with caches. Real memories aren't actually that good. But the idea is that that these caches will, like 90% of the time, or more, will give you that single cycle performance. 90% of the time they'll act that way. But sometimes you'll be unlucky, and they'll take a lot longer. They'll take like 300 to 400 plus cycles to do a read or a write. And in that case, you're going to need to stall. And this is unlike any of the stalling we've talked about before. So when we've talked about stalling before, you could just look at the instructions and say, this is going to stall or this isn't going to stall. With these memory accesses, because the memory changes what it does depending on something we'll talk about later today, we'll have something which is not so predictable. So the simplest way of dealing with this is that sometimes our memory stage needs to take a bunch of extra cycles and everything behind it needs to wait. So we take, you know, our ideal timeline, we do these two loads and add, right, one after another, and we do forwarding and everything's nice, nice and fast. We have one cycle of stalling, but with these variable speed memories, sometimes we might get unlucky and we do these two loads and they both take like 5 cycles. And everything behind must wait. And if you remember, we talked about the performance impacts of things like stalling on returns or hazards, and how this like dramatically decreased sort of the throughput of our processor because we had this higher cycles per instruction. And this is a big cause of that sort of problem. If our memories do this a lot of the time, you know, even a relatively small portion of the time for waiting like 5 cycles, that's going to be pretty bad. And this is, in fact, in practice, one of the biggest sources of not getting that sort of ideal throughput, is that we need to wait for the memory. And things that are need those values need to wait behind the things waiting for the memory. So there's another thing I'll mention briefly today about how real pipeline processors work, and they do things which are fancier than what the pipeline processor we talked about do. So we're not going to talk about how to implement these techniques because they make hazard handling much harder, but these are ways of dealing with hazards and getting just more efficiency out of a pipeline than we've seen how to get. So one idea, which is relatively simple conceptually, but not so simple to implement, is let's just start multiple instructions at once. So this is called multiple issue because starting an instruction is called issuing it. And the idea is we make 2 copies of our pipeline and we have a shared register file. So we like take the register file, instead of having it read 2 registers at a time, we have it read 4. Instead of having it write 2 registers at a time, we have it write 4. And we do the same for our memory. Instead of reading 1 value at a time, we have it read 2, and so on. So we implement that, and then we can start 2 instructions at once and have them go through this double wide pipeline. This makes hazard handling much, much more complicated. If you think about this, we have a whole bunch of forwarding to do, and the general case for forwarding is a lot more complicated. It was already pretty bad. You're already going to have a lot of cases you're going to need to write for forwarding. Something like this is a lot worse, and I haven't even talked about when do we need to stall in this. But this is something real processors do. So they just have these extra parts of the pipeline, and they can start multiple instructions at once. So their ideal performance is not finish 1 instruction every cycle, but finish 2 or 3 or 4. So another thing that real processors do is find work to do out of the order of the program. So when we saw that case where we had a value being fetched from memory and we needed to wait behind it, we stall all the instructions while we were waiting for the value from memory, that's pretty annoying. So if we have 1 slow memory access, we can't do anything. And lots of processors actually find something to do. So they will look at 4 instructions while we're waiting on memory that, you know, can do their execute step. And they'll just find other work to do based on just what values are available to run things that have been fetched. And this basically means that instead of pipeline registers, you have a list of available instructions and you need to somehow choose them. This means that all the logic of pipelining is much more complicated than this. But the advantage is that when we're waiting on memory, we can find useful work to do, hopefully. Sort of lower the impact of that slow memory and anything else which might be slower, and lower the impact of hazards in general. We can find other work to do to fill the slots we have availability. And these processors, of course, still want to look like a normal processor, which runs 1 instruction at a time. So they'll typically finish the work in order. So that's why you see these write-back stages happen still in the program order. It's just that the work in the middle doesn't. So more so than that multiple issue where we had more instructions going on at once, this makes hazard handling way, way more complicated because we still want to do forwarding within all these pending instructions, and you need to figure out which instructions to run, which have hazards, which don't. So this is a lot more complicated to implement, but it's considered worth it typical laptop or desktop processors use this technique, along with multiple issue. So any questions about those advanced pipelining techniques? So we're not going to talk about how to implement these, as I said. A bit later, we'll talk about what this out-of-order execution means for you as a programmer trying to get good performance from a processor. So anticipate that. Okay, so when we talked about branch prediction, we used a really stupid strategy for branch prediction. We just said, jumps, always take it. So real processors do things which are much more complicated, and there's some simple things you can do which are better. It's just sort of the starting point for better branch prediction. So one example, and this gives you an idea of the sort of intuition which is behind many branch prediction techniques, is that you predict branches which go forward, which go to a higher address as taken, and ones which go to a lower, as not taken, sorry, and ones which go to a lower address as taken. And the reason this works is if you think about loops, the branch to a lower address is returning to the beginning of the loop. The branch to the higher address is exiting the loop. So this predicts loops right most of the time. And this is a simple heuristic, and if you do this, you get a big boost in your branch prediction performance over predicting always taken. So this is one example of something you can do that's really simple, and sort of where processors would start with doing their branch prediction. They, in fact, use even more complicated techniques, of course, than this, but this is, you know, the first step. This is basically sort of the best thing you can do without looking very carefully at the instructions. You just look at whether it's less than or greater at destination address. So another thing real processors do is they do branch prediction for return. And this seems like something we couldn't do, because how do we even have a guess for where return might go? And the way real processors solve this is by having a little extra data structure in the processors. So when you do a call, they have this extra copy of part of the stack that they push the return address onto the real stack, and this extra copy that's going to be in CPU registers. Since it's in CPU registers, it's going to be limited in size. It will sometimes run out of room. And that means we won't have the real return addresses in there. Also, you could write a return address without using call. But all this is fine because the consequence of having the wrong value in that partial copy in the registers is just that we make a wrong prediction. And we just recover from that the same way we recovered from a conditional jump being mispredicted. And when you get it right, of course, you're saving a whole bunch of cycles where previously you'd wait to get a value from memory. So this is something many real processors do to make returns typically fast. So in the cases where we happen to have a copy of the return address in that small subset of the stack that we're storing in the CPU, it's fast. Where it's not, it's no slower than before. So another thing I'd like to note, because you know, your impression about branch prediction is that you fetch the instruction, you look at it a little bit, and from that you make a prediction about where to go next. So real processors sometimes take multiple cycles to fetch instructions, or sometimes have to deal with instruction encodings which are so complicated that it takes multiple cycles to figure out like where the opcode is. And because of this, real processors need to predict branches before they can figure out where the opcodes are. And this is something they in fact do. And that seems like, based on how we've discussed branch prediction, impossible. How do you know anything about where an instruction goes if you haven't even seen it? And the basic strategy here is that processors are going to have extra data structures where they'll keep copies of, these are the branches I recently saw. And they'll look at that to do their first part of their branch prediction. Any questions about anything about branch prediction? So we're going to move on to caching next. So start by talking about caching and range prediction in general, and what processors use space for. So this is a micrograph of a 2004 processor. It's a 2004 processor because you can more clearly see features on that, and I could find someone who meticulously figured out where most of the components of the processor were on the micrograph, which doesn't exist for many more recent ones. And you can see that most of the space in the processor is devoted to caches, which are sort of data storage. And considerably more than, say, is devoted to registers. And also considerably more than is devoted to doing actual computation. So the actual computation in this processor happens somewhere in this box here and in this box here. Everything else is either part of implementing caches or memories, figuring out how to deal with pipeline hazards and the like, or dealing with things like branch prediction. And you can see I've highlighted where probably most of the branch prediction logic is, which is bigger than the registers. And that's pretty typical. So modern processors, most of their space is not devoted to doing the actual computation, but all this logic around it, because you saw we had a lot of logic for pipelining, and they're doing even more complicated things. And we also really care about making our memories fast, and we devote a lot of space to that. I guess a final word about this idea of optimizing pipelines with a sort of anecdote. So all this stuff where we deal with hazards and cache efficiency, this is a case where we really pay for that latency trade-off. So when I introduced pipelining, talked about how we had longer latency, and for the most part, we didn't care. Like, we were just doing more instructions. But because of hazards, and you know, things like slow caches, branch mispredictions, we end up sometimes doing less instructions. So Intel, in around 2000, had this idea that they're going to really take advantage of pipelining. They're going to do lots and lots of pipelining, and they're going to focus on having a really, really high clock rate. So they're going to finish lots of instructions every cycle. You know, they also had multiple issues, so lots of instructions every cycle on average. And so they released this processor in 2000, which on its initial release had a 50% higher clock rate than their competitors. So the theoretical number of instructions you could run was much higher than their competitors. To do this, they had 2 to 3 times the pipeline stages. Counting pipeline stages is a little tricky, but it's something like 20 to 30 pipeline stages. So they divided up the work of the instruction into lots of little pieces. And this was an out-of-order, multiple-issue processor, did all the tricks we talked about to make things fast. And here's a quote from a review of the first generation of this processor. "For today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. It's more expensive, it also used RAM, that was a weird type of RAM, more expensive. So this processor, even though it was theoretically faster, and even though you could find programs on which it was much faster, for typical programs, because of things like hazards and cache misses and branch mispredication, it ended up being slower, even though it had a 50% higher clock rate." Sort of the summary was they were aiming for an even higher clock rate than that and didn't get it. And that's why it was so bad. Oh, and so this is the sort of trade-offs we're balancing when we design a pipeline. Okay. So off to talk about caches. So I have this picture I showed you a second ago. So here are our registers. So our registers are our fastest data storage. Ideally, we'd like to just compute on everything in registers because they're really fast to access. We access multiple of them every instruction. There's no slowdown whatsoever. But we also want a bigger memory. And so we have these caches. So we have this first, this L1 cache. So these are pretty small. They're kind of pretty fast. But they don't hold that much. And this processor, I think they're like 32K each, or some 16 or 32K each. Then we have a bigger cache. So this holds more, but because it's bigger, it's slower. So this is a megabyte L2 cache in this case, L2 for level 2. So it's bigger, it's slower, but holds more data, so we can do more with it, but at less speed. And on a modern processor, typically there's even another layer of cache, something even bigger proportionally, usually an L3 cache that you might have. And then finally you go to main memory. So on this chip, there's this part labeled the DDR memory interface. That's where wires would connect to something external to the chip where main memory was. So each of these have, you know, bigger and bigger capacities. They're physically bigger, which is because they can hold more. But there's a cost in performance. So our registers, we can access them basically every cycle. And it's a multi-gigahertz processor these days, so they have sub-nanosecond access time. That's pretty typical. An L1 cache, it's going to take like a nanosecond to access. It's a bit slower. We have to have an instruction go through a few pipeline stages to get to the memory. L2 cache, something like 5 nanoseconds. L3, typically something like 20. And main memory is something like 100. These are all approximate numbers. You can find different ranges for all these values depending on who designed the chip, what generation it is, and so on. These are typically the ranges you've seen for the past decade or so. And the idea is that the L1 cache talks to the L2 cache and so on. And hopefully we get the performance of that like 1 nanosecond. So the caches, as I said, they're what that instruction memory and data memory component we saw in our processor really are. And they have the inputs we talked about, but they have this additional little thing to deal with not always being fast. So they still are gonna take in an address and output a value, or take in an address and an input and write a value. But they can't always do that fast. And because of that, they're gonna have this extra signal to tell us whether or not we need to stall. The signal about, is the value ready, or is my write complete, or do I need to wait? Do I need to have the processor stall? Do I need to find other stuff to do? So this is the interface we're providing. And the way it works is that, you know, when it's not ready, it's probably not ready because it's speaking to the next level of cache. So we'll use our small, fast storage if we can. If we can't, it's going to say, I'm not ready, and it's going to speak for us to the next level of cache. So this means our typical pattern, one way you can think about this, is the CPU asks the cache, hey, I'd like to read address A, B, C, D. The cache says, huh, I don't know that. I'm going to talk to my next cache or RAM. Hey, could you please read A, B, C, D? It's going to come back to the cache. The cache is going to forward it to the CPU. On the other hand, the CPU might ask, hey, I'd like to read 1, 2, 3, 4. The cache is going to say, oh, I have a copy of that somewhere. And it's just going to give it back without talking to the next level. In either case, the cache is intermediating anything the CPU sends to memory. So everything goes through the cache first, and the cache may need to forward it out to memory. It may be able to handle it itself. So this is our interface we provide to the cache. So the goal of our memory hierarchy, the reason we have these caches, is that we'd like to give the performance of these small pieces of data storage. So the small storage that's close to the processor is going to be really fast when we can use that small storage. So we want to have the performance of the fastest type of memory we have, which is the type of memory we have in the L1 cache. But we want to provide the illusion of the capacity of the largest memory. And the way we want to do this is that we want it to be very infrequent that our cache will need to say, hey, I'm not ready, I'm talking to the next level. I'm talking to RAM, I'm talking to the level 2. So you want, you know, we have this 100x latency difference, so it's like 1 nanosecond for L1, 100 for the main memory. We need something like a 99%+ rate where we don't need to talk to the next level, which we'll call a hit rate. And this is what we're going to aim for with our cache design. And this seems like something that, you know, might not be possible. And indeed, in general, it's not. If I have a program which just accesses memory randomly, you can't do this. You're not gonna be able to do this for me. You're not gonna even be able to approximate it. I'm gonna get the performance of the slowest memory, if that happens. But there's some assumptions we're gonna make about what real programs do that are hopefully gonna let us approximately achieve both these objectives. That we're gonna get something which looks like the performance of the small memory. You know, it's nice and fast, but too small to store all our things. And something which looks like the capacity of our slow, large memory, you know, which is big enough to store many gigabytes, but it's not so fast, it takes like 100 nanoseconds to access. And this is going to depend on assumptions we'll call locality. And there's two types of locality we're going to be concerned with. So one is temporal locality. And temporal locality is the rule, if I access something now, I'm going to access it again soon. And if we think this happens, then the thing our caches should do is they should say, if you access something, I should keep a copy of it. Because that copy is going to be useful. And another type of locality we'll be concerned about is spatial locality, which is if I access a value, I'm going to access adjacent or otherwise nearby values soon. And what this means for the cache is that when you access a value, I should not only store that value, I should store nearby values in my fast memory so you can access them quickly. So note that these are properties that are typically true of programs. They're natural properties of programs, but they're not guaranteed. You can write a program which doesn't have either of these properties. But typical programs are going to do that. So let's look at an example of some simple program which has all our locality. So this is compute a mean. So one thing that people often miss when we're talking about locality is that one of the most important kinds of locality we have is with, not kind, but you know, categories of locality, is with instructions. We do more accesses to the instruction memory than the data memory. You know, it's actually very important, can we fetch our instructions quickly? So if we think about the machine code here, we have this loop that's executed many, many times. The machine code of that loop is accessed repeatedly. We have good temporal locality there. There's the property we accessed it. We're going to access it again. This is typical code with loops. Also, most of our instructions are right next to each other. Yes, we have this backwards jump in the loop, but otherwise, the next instruction we're running is probably the one after it in memory. So we have good spatial locality in the code. I can predict predict without looking at the instructions what memory of machine code is important to get. If we start thinking about the data, we have several variables here that we access repeatedly. We have total, I, length. Those are all accessed repeatedly, so we have good temporal locality on that. Now, our compiler probably put those variables in registers, which is the compiler sort of taking advantage of temporal locality itself. It observed these values are good things to put in registers because they're accessed repeatedly, and registers, if you remember, were the top of our memory hierarchy. They're even faster than the cache. But that was possible because there was temporal locality in those variables. We also have spatial locality in this array. So the array values is accessed exactly once. There's no repeated accesses whatsoever. So the temporal locality is actually horrible. But we have good spatial locality because when we access values I, we're going to access values I plus 1. And this is something the cache can take advantage of to, even though we're only accessing something once, to actually give us better performance than if we were going just straight to memory on this. So any questions about all these types of locality? How we identify when there's locality. Okay. So let's look at how we build a cache. So we know what we want the cache to do. We know what we're taking advantage of, these locality ideas. So let's say we have some memory, and I want to turn it into a cache. So in this case, I have 8 bytes of memory. 8 bits of fast memory, and I want to turn it into a cache. So the first decision I need to make is, what sort of size chunks am I dividing this memory up into? And this is going to have an impact on spatial locality. So if I take chunks of only one byte, then I'm not keeping things together that weren't together in memory. I take larger chunks, I have less flexibility about what's in my cache, but I'm keeping things that were together in memory together in my cache, which will let me take advantage of spatial locality. We're doing that thing where if we access a value, we're bringing in the adjacent things. So in this case, I've arbitrarily chosen that I'm going to take in blocks of 2 bytes. So my cache block size is going to be 2 bytes. I'm going to divide up my 8 bytes of memory into 4 2-byte chunks. And I need to decide some way in which to map these 2-byte chunks to parts of the total memory. And I'm going to choose, to keep things nice and simple, to make it easy for me to implement my cache and hardware, that I'm going to divide memory up into 2-byte chunks. And each thing I keep in the cache is going to correspond to one of those 2-byte chunks of memory. So this means that I'm not going to keep 11, 11, 2, 1, 1, 2, 2 in one block here. I'm going to only keep 0, 0, 1, 1 or 2, 2, 3, 3. It's going to only go to a block. Each of those pairs together, I'm not going to divide things up in another way. I could design a cache where I do that, but it's going to be more complicated. It's not going to be worth doing, so I'm just going to divide it up this way. And one decision I need to make is, if I'm reading a value from this cache, where do I look? I have 4 slots. How do I figure out which slot or slots I look at? Which places I might have put the value? So I'm reading some value. You know, I need to figure out where could this value have been. And one option is I could say it's anywhere. I'm going to choose something that's simpler to implement. I only have one place to look. So I'm going to decide that the first block of my cache corresponds to the first bytes of memory, the second first bytes of memory, and the second block of my cache corresponds to the second bytes of memory, and so on, until I run out of spaces, and then I'm going to wrap around. So first block corresponds to 0, then 4, 8, and so on. So I get this mapping. So I just repeat sort of copies of my cache about where things can be stored. I'm doing this strategy instead of saying, for example, the first byte stores things in the first half of memory or something like that, because this means that at least my cache can store, you know, 0, 0, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3 all together, which is good for spatial locality. You can store them in 2 separate blocks. And by choosing this policy, I have exactly one place to look for this address here. And this property of there being exactly one place I need to look for something to be stored is called a direct map cache, and it's the simplest kind as far as implementing it in hardware. So I'm reading this byte here, and if I look at the address I have, 01011, I find out that it maps to the second block. It happens that you can look at the middle bits of the address to figure that out. We'll go through how you figure out what bits correspond that way. And you can see that that works out to match our mapping. So I know that this block is where I could have the value I want to read. So I need to figure out, is it there? And I'm doing a cache read, this is what I have, I forget if it's there, and I'm missing information to do that. Here I just see 2 zeros. I don't know whether or not memory contains 2 zeros at that address or not. I don't know. I didn't write down that information. And the only way I can determine it right now is by actually going to memory, which is what we're trying to avoid in the first place. So I need to write down some extra information. And one thing I'm missing is whether or not I even stored anything there. You know, is it zeros because I just booted, or is it zeros because that's what memory actually contains? So I need to add this extra bit to know, is there even a value there? This is called a valid bit. So the valid bit tells me, did I just boot up and I don't have anything stored? Or is there a value there that might be the one I'm looking for? Okay. So now I know there's a value there. So the next thing I need to know, where did this value come from? So on this picture, I have 2 places that this value I have here could come from. I need to know which one it is. When I'm trying to read, I need to figure out, is the value I'm reading from the address with AABB or the address with 2233. I want to know that, and I want to know that without asking memory, please check. So I need to keep a copy of information sufficient to figure that out, and that information we're going to call a tag. So in this case, a tag is the entire part of the address we didn't use. So one thing you can notice, if you look here, is that everything before the index, we have all zeros, then all ones, then all twos, and so on. And that's just property because we have the places where we can store a particular thing are separated by 8. 8 because that's the number of bytes we store in the cache. So we just need those upper bits to figure out the information about the address we don't already know based on where things are in the cache. So the tag is those extra bits which tell us where did we get this value. I could have also stored the full address I got that value from, but it's not necessary because not every address can end up in that part of the cache. So the tag is the minimum information I need. Okay. So any questions about what these sort of how I organize this cache here? Yes. The valid and tag?
The valid column.
Yeah, so the valid column, the question is, can I talk more about the valid column? So the valid column is about whether I have any value stored there whatsoever. So because this is actually a memory, it's something which stores bits, I'm always going to have some sort of value in the value part and some sort of value in the tag part. So I need some extra information to know whether that even makes sense. And that's going to be the valid bit.
So earlier, when there was nothing in the valid, and you pulled it over.
Yeah, so I pulled it over, so I showed it with, yeah, so there's nothing in the valid here. Now I showed it if we're storing an AABB. So this is the setup. If we try to read AABB, there's nothing there is what we find out. This is the setup. If we try to read it, we find out, yep, it's there. Okay. Any other questions about this picture? Okay. So this is the basic way caches work. So we're going to divide our address. So the user cache, we're going to have this organization. We're going to have a bunch of rows, which are called sets. And the set contains the actual data we're storing, the values that came from memory, hopefully. These valid bits to tell us if there's anything useful in the row. And a tag to tell us the rest of the address, where this came from in memory. And the way the memory works physically is that we're going to be able to send a value, which is the index of a row, and we're going to get the bits of that row spit out. And then we can look at them. So that's how it's going to work physically. That's why it's organized like this. And we're going to divide up our address into three pieces. So the bottom piece I'm going to call the offset, or the block offset. So in this case, I have two bits. I have two bits because I have 4 bytes stored in each row of this cache. And to know which of those 4 bytes I'm referring to, I need 2 bits. And those bottom 2 bits of the address are going to tell me whether, you know, the value I'm reading is B4, B5, B6, or B7 when I get the right row. Then I have the index. So the next bits in the address tell me which row of the cache might have my value. And everything left over, everything we didn't use to find the byte we care about, is the tag. So when I actually access this cache, I'm going to take those what are called index bits to find the right row. I'm going to pull out the bits of the row. They're going to be spit out. I'm going to compare the tag. And I'm also going to check the valid bit. And though the tag is equal and the valid bit is true, I have a cache hit. I can return the value I just got out of this row without doing any more work. And the next thing I need to do is I need to take that offset and extract the byte that we actually care about. So in this case, I have 4 bytes, so I have this 4-way mux. that I use with the offset bits to figure out the exact byte that I was asked for. Yes? So why is the tag before the index is the question. So the purpose of having the tag, so we could have put the tag after the index. We could have swapped them. And this would be a crash which operates correctly, but is less good at taking advantage of locality. So the cache as it is now, if we have a bunch of data which is next to each other in memory, it can all go in the cache. If I put the index bits at top, they all go to the same row if they're next to each other in memory, like adjacent blocks. And that would mean that the cache would be less good at storing things that are spatially, that are next to each other, and be less good at taking advantage of spatial locality. So that's why we made the decision that the index bits are next. So one way you can think about it is that the cache, if you access just a block of memory that's the size of the cache and contiguous, the cache can hold the whole thing. That's a consequence, a deliberate consequence of our cache design, is to make that happen. Because that's the sort of example of the best spatial and temporal locality you can have. Is that if I have a 1 meg cache, I'm only accessing 1 meg of data and it's all next to each other in memory. We want that to work, so we'll make choices which make that be able to stay entirely in the cache. If it's 1 meg. So other questions on how we look up things in the cache? So you may have noticed that our first step to actually accessing the cache was splitting up the address into these three components, tag, index, and offset. And these are based on how many bits we need to determine different things. So for the offset, it's how many bits do we need to determine which byte of a block we're referring to. For the index, it's how many bits do we need to determine which set, which row we're referring to. And for the tag, it's everything that's left over. How much do we have after that? So if we have this address here, which stores the value FF in each of these caches with different organizations, let's figure out how to divide it up. So first, we need to figure out the size of the offsets. And to look at that, we look at the number of bytes in a block, because the offset tells us which byte in the block is this address referring to, since the address is for a single byte. So if we have 2 byte blocks, then 1 bit tells us which of those 2 bytes we're referring to. So we need 1 bit for the offset. So these first two, the offset is 1, the last bit of the address. For the other case, we have 4 byte blocks, so we need 2 bits to say which of the 4 bits we're referring to. Which means that the offset is 1, 1, the last 2 bits of this address. So then we look at the number of sets, that's the number of rows. So if we have 4 sets, we need 2 bits to tell which of the 4 sets to look inside for our value. So that's 2 bits we extract from the address. So if we have sort of 8 sets, we need 3 bits to determine it. So that's 3 bits we extract from the address, and if we have 2 sets, we need 1 bit to determine it. And everything left over is the tag. So notice that for each of these caches, if I read the tag, followed by the index, followed by the offset, I get back the original address. That's why the tag is enough information to tell us exactly what part of memory is stored there. Because we know the tag, plus we know what row it's in, the index, which we don't have to store because it's just it's based on where it is located physically. And we know the offset being based on which of the bytes, of the several bytes we have stored, there it is. So this is how we divide up an address, and you can reason about just this component by component. First figure out how much space we need for the offset, then figure out how many sets we have, therefore how much space we need to, how many space we need to determine which set we're looking at, and so on. And so our book has formulas for this. This is a perfectly valid way of going about it, is to take the numbers you know and do algebra. That's equivalent to the reasoning we were doing before. So for example, this here is saying if we have, you know, if we have eight sets, then we need, you know, 3 bits, 2^3 is 8, to determine which of those 8 sets we're referring to. That's encoding exactly that reasoning. So one notable thing here is that we have this formula for cache size. And it says that cache size is the number, the block size times the number of sets. This is for direct map cache. We'll have another case later. So note that this doesn't include all the data in the cache. So here, we store these 2-byte values, plus we store 3 extra bits of information for each row. That's not part of what we call the cache size. The cache size is just the amount of data in the cache. We have this extra information we need to store to make the cache work. We don't call that part of the cache size. So that 1 megabyte cache I showed you earlier actually has more than 1 megabyte of storage because it needs to store various valid bits and tag bits in addition to the actual data. So let's step through what happens with a cache. So first, you know, I have this cache here, and I want to figure out how to divide up my addresses. So I could use the formulas, and I could use the reasoning. So here I have 2-byte blocks. So I have 2-byte blocks. That means there's going to be 2 places to put a byte. I need 1 bit to determine which of those 2 places I'm referring to. And that's going to be exactly the least significant bit of the address. So this first address here has a 0 there, so it uses the first byte of the block. The second address has a 1 lower bit, so it uses the second byte of the block, and so on. I have 4 sets. So I need 2 bits to determine which one I'm referring to. You can see that very clearly if you label the sets like I did here in binary. So I'm going to use the next 2 bits of the address after the block offset to determine which set I put that address in. Everything left over needs to be the tab. So this is how I end up dividing my address. The autumn bit's the offset, the next 2 bits are the index, the remaining 5 bits are the tap. So then I can look at what happens when I access this cache in this pattern. So first, I access the address 0. So I'm going to say 0. That corresponds to index 0. So I look, extract index 0 from the cache, and I check whether the tag matches or the valid bit is set. I find out the valid bit isn't set, so it's a miss. And given our policy about locality earlier, what are we going to do when we have a cache miss? What are we going to want to do?
Check memory next.
Yeah, so we check the next level of memory, and we're going to actually get the value. And part of our job as a cache is to forward it back to the CPU. So what should we do to the cache with the value we get? Should we store it or should we not? Should we sometimes store it? What does people have opinions? So when we have a miss, what's the best thing to do? Should we store that value in our cache? Should we not? Should we sometimes store it? Should it depend? Someone? No, so I've just read 0. In this case, should I write it to the cache? Or should I leave it the cache as is? So why should I write it?
There's nothing in the cache.
There's nothing there, so I definitely should write it. So, and note that we have this idea of temporal locality. So we have this assumption that if I've accessed address 0, I'm going to access it again. Since we're making that assumption, it's actually always going to make sense for us to store the value. We're always going to store a value that's a miss, because we assume it's going to be accessed again, or if not, that adjacent values, which might be other parts of the same cache block, are going to be accessed again. So because of our locality assumptions, it's always the right thing to, when we have a cache miss, to replace that value regardless of whether it's valid. If it's invalid, it's a no-brainer. It couldn't possibly hurt to put the value there. So when we have a cache miss, we're going to actually store the value we got from address 0. So we're going to update the tag to say, I'm storing address 0 through 1 here. And we're also going to take the values from memory corresponding to that block. Note that even though we've read 1 byte, we need to store two because that's the size of our blocks. So then here we access address one. So I follow the same procedure as before. I look at the index bits, they're both zeros. So I look at the first row, I say, okay, let's compare the tag. Tags all zeros, equals all zeros, good. I check the valid bit is one. So it's there's something actually there. And I say, yep, it's a hit. So that second access is a hit, and it's a hit because our cache was doing the right thing for spatial locality. It decided since we access zero, we're likely to access one, and it did that by putting them together in the same block. So then I have this next access. Here I act the index bits for address 6-3 in hex are 0-1. I look at the second row, there was nothing there, so I'm going to get the value, forward it back to the CPU, and as I do so, I'm going to store it in that spot in the cache. So here, we access address 6-1. So it has index bits of 0, so I take out this first row, I find out, yup, it's valid, and I compare the tags. I have an all zeros tag versus 0-1-1-0-0. So they don't agree, so it's a miss. So there's something stored there, but it's not the value I was asking for. It's a different part of memory that we were storing there. And if you remember what we said about locality, we're going to replace that value. We're going to say, because you just accessed it, I assume you're going to access it again soon, and you accessed it more recently, so you're more likely to access it than whatever was stored there before. So we're just going to replace that value and store this new memory address. Then we access address 6-2. That's in the cache. We look in, we say index 1, we check this row, we check the tags, they match, therefore it must be in there, and we actually extract the value. So then we access address 0 again. And if we look in this cache, we say index 0, we compare this tag 0110 to 0. It's a miss because the tags disagree. Even though there's a valid value there, it's a value for a different part of memory, so that's a miss. And just like before, we're going to replace it with the value we just read because we assume that's more likely to be accessed soon. Then we access value 6-4. And so this is net result of our entire access pattern here. So you can see that. So every time we have a miss, we need to replace the value in the cache. That's sort of our policy. This is how we're going to take advantage of temporal locality. If we didn't think we had temporal locality, that might be the wrong thing to do. But since we think that's what we have temporal and spatial locality, every time we have a miss, we assume this value is more important to store than whatever's there. So one thing worth noting is that we have what is called a conflict miss here. That we have these three accesses which all go to the same set. And even though I never used the last set of this cache, it's completely empty, I still had misses for values I accessed twice. And that's because we had these limitations on where we could store values. This limitation is going to make our cache faster because when I do the access, I only access one row rather than multiple all the rows and scanning for a value. But it means that I have this cost where sometimes I could have been more clever. I could have found a way to store all these values, but I didn't. And that's a disadvantage of this kind of cache. So we'll talk about sort of improvements on that, but they're not going to be as fast as caches when their things are hit. Okay, so let's start with a different cache organization. So here I have a cache with 4-byte blocks and 4 sets, still direct mapped. And the first part is I have this address here. So I was just writing this down. So how would you split this up into a tag, index, and offset for this cache? So if you're not sure where to start, start with the block offset bits, which remember are about which byte in a block. And those are the least significant bits of the address. So write this, figure this out, check that you and your neighbor agree. Check back in a minute or two. Also, I have formulas on the side if you want to try that strategy. Yes.
When there's a byte, you have like a 0000, that's one byte,
right? So each,
each zero, each double zero is a
yeah, byte. Because it's two hex digits. Okay, who's still working? Okay, someone want to share their answer? Yeah. So 0110 is the tag, index is 00, then 01. Yeah. So how did you figure that out? We can tell the index is 2 bits because we needed 2 bits to number everything.
And then the offset is 2 bits because they're 4-byte blocks.
Mm-hmm. Offset is 2 bits, yeah, because they're 4-byte blocks. 2 to the 2 is 4, or another way of thinking about it is 2 bits to number each of 4 things. And the remainder was the tag. And it's always in this tag, then index, then offset order. So you can figure that out with the formulas. Block size is 4 equals 2 to the b, take the log, and so on. So we get this division of the addresses. So given that, this next part, figure out how many accesses are hits. And so the way you almost certainly should do this is by keeping track of the state of the cache as you move on. Like, you can do it by like looking backwards and seeing where does the index match up, which is not horrible, but not my favorite way of doing it. Like, that's fine if it works for you. Okay, who's still working? Okay, a couple of people. I have another 30 seconds or so. You're allowed to talk, but not work in silence. You never tell anyone what you're doing. Okay, who's willing to share an answer? Anyone who hasn't spoken today, preferably? Who's not finished still? Okay, so I guess I will go through this then. So the procedure is, first we have access to zero. We look in the cache, so assuming that things are initially invalid. That's logical assumption, or somehow not that. Then we access address zero. It's not valid, so it's a miss. That's all we need to know the result, but because it's a miss, we're gonna store that value. So we're gonna have, it's gonna be valid. We're gonna have the tag is all zeros. And we're gonna store addresses 0 through 3. So then we access address 1 that has a tag of all zeros and is in index 0, so it's a hit. The tag matches in that index, and it's valid, so we're good. Then we access address 6-3. It's in index 0. The tag does not match what's currently there, so it's a miss. And because we had a miss, we're going to replace what was here with that tag, and that's going to be, instead of addresses 0 through 3, addresses 60 through 63, which you can figure out by figuring out what the binary with offset of 0 is to get the beginning. So then we access address 61 that goes to the index 0, tag matches, it's one of these 60 to 63, so that's a hit. And the same thing is true with 6-2, since it only differs in the block offset bits. Then we access address 0 again. That's, we look at index 0, the tag doesn't match, so it's a miss. But as part of handling that miss, we replace this with zeros again, and we have, again, address 0 through 3 here. Then we access address 6-4, that's in index 1. There's nothing there right now, so it's a miss. And we also replace the nothing that was there with the values from addresses 64 to 67. Okay. Yeah.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Two different things when you were storing the value. For one of them, you did 60 to 63, and the other one, you did 64 to 67. How did you choose?
So 6-4 is this, the lower number is the block offset bits are 0. Well, 0, the upper number is the block offset bits are all 1s. And that's the general pattern because of how we divided up memory into blocks.
So